The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
See, so it's on now. So can you hear me? Everybody can hear? So maybe you could turn it up a teeny bit. So let's see, is that easier? Great. So in January, I started a four-part series on concentration, the samadhi practice, and I gave two of those talks, and now tonight and then next week, I'll give this last two talks of the series. And when I think of samadhi, the Buddhist word for concentration or concentration states, I think of sweetness. It's very sweet. Sometimes I think of it, there's a variety of different concentration states, and those states have different textures and flavors to them, depending on the state. Some of them feel very sweet. Some feel, lately I've been thinking of them as being silken, like silk or satin, the feeling on the inside. It just feels so nice to feel satin maybe. And imagine your insides felt just like smooth satin. And then that's all there was, smooth satin feeling. So we live in many different states of mind. And the ordinary states of minds themselves are variable. Sometimes they're, you know, we might call it moods, different kind of moods, and it goes up and down through the day. And there's a wide range of states of mind, wide range of moods, wide range of states of being that we can abide in, be in. And in meditation, when we close our eyes, we then have access to an expanded range of states that can be experienced. And sometimes they're called altered states of consciousness. And they come in a variety of different ways. There's many different ways in the experience because there's many different functionalities of the mind that get mobilized, get activated, and work together. And as they work together as a system, different ones of them might dominate, and so different, depending which one dominates or which comes together or which is there and not there, those states of mind have different flavors or textures or feelings to them. Some people are confused by the different kinds of states that might arise because they're so different than people's ordinary daily states of mind. Even though they might be quite rapturous, some of them, quite intense, would rather not experience them because of the intensity or because they don't recognize themselves in those states. Some of the states of consciousness have very, very little thinking going on. And when we mostly orient ourselves to the world, orient ourselves to ourselves through our thinking, it can be frightening even, or very unwelcoming to not have those thoughts operate. Sometimes people go into deep states of stillness, and then those deep stillness, again, this is so, the landmarks for how we understand our lives are not there, and so people get frightened. Some people hear about the different states of consciousness that can come with samadhi, and some of them are so pleasant that, or sound so wonderful, that people get very desirous of them and just want them. Some people are very eager to have signs of progress in meditation practice, because if you can have, you know, signposts like I've gotten, you know, to this stage and this stage and this stage, then you know you're being successful, and so it can be very alluring, very to want to have those signposts. There's also a distinction that's made between sometimes between the practices of mindfulness and the practices of samadhi, and that the practice of samadhi, and that the argument is sometimes is made, these are very distinct practices, and one is the right way and the other is not. And you should, you know, some people, different people, there's a different divide. Some people take one as being important, some people the other are important. And I'll talk more about that next week. What I want to do tonight is describe to you some of the key states of samadhi, key states of concentration that are celebrated in the Buddhist tradition and are considered to be important by some people as foundation stones or stepping stones for the process of liberation. And one of the reasons to learn about them is to recognize them when they come, so that if you fall into these, some people they use the language of falling into sometimes, that when you fall into them, that you are not frightened by them. When you fall into them, you recognize them a little bit for what they are, and you recognize them as being on the map of meditation practice, on the map of helpful states of mind. And so you can maybe cultivate them, encourage them, and move through them in a useful way. So without being frightened by them, or without being confused by them, or without being lost in these states. What are they? If we take the ordinary state of mind to be a mind that's fragmented or distracted, distracted by its distractions, it doesn't know it's distracted. So caught up that, you know, just that, you know, it's kind of like a black hole. With a black hole, the idea being that it's so much gravitational force that you get close to the black hole, light falls in, and you can't see anything. You get close to these black holes in the thinking mind, fantasy and aversion and desire, whatever. You get close enough to the strength of them, you fall into those, and you get lost. You don't even know you're there. And so important part of concentration practice is to overcome those distracting forces. So the mind is not lost in its thoughts. And so it's one way or the other, as we do concentration practice, we want to come to a point where we don't have to make any effort anymore to avoid succumbing to our thinking. And that's a turning point in the world of meditation. And so for many people, most of us, when we sit down to meditate, the mind is busy, it wants to go off, and we bring it back. Mind goes off, and we bring it back. And it takes some effort to do that. Or if you're able to stay present, you have to kind of give a little oomph, a little effort to stay there because you know there's a strong tendency to want to go off. As this meditative mind gets stronger and as the forces of distractions get lessen, it becomes easier and easier just to stay present. At some point where it's relatively effortless to stay because the mind has no tendency to go off. If the mind doesn't want to go off, then you don't have to make any effort to stay present. So at some point, there's a transition that happens when the mind is no longer distracting itself into its thoughts and concerns. So the way to get there is in meditation, is first you have the period of preparation, sitting yourself up, preparing yourself, and there's a whole series of things you do to prepare yourself. Some of them are just very ordinary, like you sit down to meditate, to do something which gets you kind of going and into it. Sit up straight, take some deep breaths. Some people like to do some chanting. Some people will remember something inspiring. Some people will do metta, loving kindness practice. Some people will set their intention very clearly. It's a variety of things we do to kind of get established and settled. One of the key ones that I found is to use my body, to connect my body and have a relatively good posture that at least from the inside feels like I'm rooted, I'm present, I'm here. To use my body as a reminder to be here. And then to switch the focus of attention the best we can from thinking to sensing. And this is a very important transition. And some of it has to be done consciously and with choice. We choose to switch the focus of the mind from its thoughts and concerns, what happened at work, what's happening tomorrow, whatever we're thinking about. And instead of thinking about things, we want to sense what's going on. And sensing, as you can imagine, only happens in the present moment. And because, you know, you can sense tomorrow, but then, then you have to think about sensing tomorrow. You can't feel tomorrow, you have to feel now. So to sense. And so begin sense, so whatever the focus of attention we're using for concentration, we want to start sensing the experience. And sensing, so for example, if you're staying with the breath, you want to sense the breath, you want to feel the experience of breathing. Or some people use the idea of an inner sight. You see something. Sometimes there's you kind of see with the mind's eye something. But the feeling, the sensing, in order to make that switch, to help us make that switch from thinking to sensing, to being present. So then we focus on if the breath. And I've used the breath as my primary concentration object, and so start focusing on the breath. And there might be some supports to kind of help stay there and keep the course with the breath. And one of them is counting the breath. So counting, you know, I used to count every exhale, got a count, and I'd count to 10, or I'd try to count to 10. And if I lost count on the way to 10, I wouldn't worry, I'd just start again at 1. If I got to 12, I knew that I kind of wasn't so present, and I'd start again at 1. And whatever, you know, I just always just start at 1 if I needed to, and try to get to 10, start again at 1. And that counting gives a thinking mind something to do that takes a little bit of effort. We have to remember the count, and fills the space to some degree of the thinking mind. So you're not so liable to be thinking as much. You're engaged in something that's here. At some point, it becomes quite clear that the mind is not caught up in its thoughts, is not caught up in the hindrances, not caught up, and it just really feels like it's going to be here. It's present. And when it starts to become present and here, then the tradition encourages us at that point to feel some delight, some relief maybe, that wow, I'm really here. My mind's not going to wander off so easily. My mind has finally been tamed. The unruly, wild mind is now tamed. It's quiet down, it's calmed down, it's not racing off everywhere, and I'm just here. And you really kind of feel I'm here. This is where I am. And so there's some delight or some relief or some appreciation of this state. Then the idea is to go is to keep focusing on the breath, but allow yourself to, as you focus on it, what I find very helpful is to have a quality or sense of allowing myself to open up or allowing myself to fall into this state of concentration, the state of being present, focused on the breath, and feeling some kind of good feelings that begin to come up. So feelings of relief, of delight, of pleasure, feelings of appreciation, feelings of well-being that begin coming. Some of it come because we're relaxed. It's very important to relax in this process. There's a freeing up of certain kind of energy in the system, in the body. And so there starts becoming feelings of well-being. And I liken it to, as I'm staying with the breath, kind of this rhythm of breathing in, breathing out, it's kind of like petting the cat. And the cat begins to purr. At first the cat doesn't purr, because you know, it's just you're a strange person to the cat, and you're petting it, and the way it looks like checking you out. And then eventually it realizes you're okay, and it relaxes, and it starts to purr. So eventually your whole system, if you stay focused and not caught up in your thoughts, the whole system begins to purr. And it starts feeling kind of this nice, sweet feeling of being concentrated and being focused. Some people, the sweetness is not so sweet. Sometimes it comes with a lot of sense of pleasure. sometimes with a sense of rapture even, and sometimes it can build and become very, very intense, sometimes with a lot of energy in the system. But first, it starts off just generally kind of sweet and nice and settled and focused. And then we're petting the cat. We're kind of massaging the pat, massaging it, and it feels good. At some point, but we have to kind of keep petting it. We have to keep coming back and stay. The mind is there. It's going to stay there, but it's only going to stay present because we keep making the effort to keep working at it. At some point, we don't have to work at being present anymore because the mind is just present. It's not going to go anywhere. And so the effort to stay present can fall away. No more effort there. And when the effort to stay present and be present falls away, it's kind of like that energy that was used there can go somewhere else. Or that focus of attention that went into that kind of effort is now available to sense and feel more fully what is here. And it's kind of like then we open up to greater feelings of rapture. And the feelings of rapture or joy can get even stronger at this point. The mind gets stiller and quieter. It's just very, very present. It's very still. But there's a feeling of upwelling energy and movement usually. Some people will feel it in different parts of their body. A very common place is to feel it in the face. Some people will feel strong pressure in their forehead, around their eyes, sometimes in their mouth. It feels like it's all puckered up because it isn't, but it just kind of feels like there's all this kind of blood flowing there, energy flowing there. Some people feel it in the chest. Some people in their hands will feel all tingly and warm and nice. Some people at this point will feel very light. The body feels very light and kind of floaty kind of feeling. Sometimes some people find that their body, they get very hot actually. People take off their clothes because of all the heat that comes along. Meditative hot flashes. At some point, as the meditation deepens, this intensity of the rapture decreases, and then as it decreases, the mind gets quieter, even still, or stiller, and a kind of sense of purity and confidence arises, and that purity and confidence, with that comes a deeper feeling of well-being that the tradition calls sukha, or happiness. And it's variable how people describe it, what it's like, but it's more sublime than the joy. Some people, when they feel the joy of meditation, these states arise, especially if it's quite strong, will think, this is the best thing ever. This is I want this forever. Some people, it's literally, people will say, this is better than an orgasm, because it's just like, who wants an orgasm when you can have this? Because it's quite that kind of intensity and that kind of feeling. So, after a while, it gets old or gets tiring, this intensity. And so at some point, there's enough of this. And some people actually start having a certain aversion to it because when it's an intensity, like, don't give me this anymore. And I've actually resisted it at times because I don't want this. And I want something that's even better. So I thought, I'll hold this at bay and not have it, not experience the more superficial joy. I want the deeper stuff. Not knowing that I have to go through the joy to get to the deeper, what's this thing called sukha, this deeper. The sukha, this more deeper, sublime well-being, is often felt as a kind of something very still and quiet, very much more peaceful, like a deep contentment or satisfaction or warmth, as opposed to an energy that's flowing and active. And then, as we open up to this deeper, as we fall into it deeper, as the momentum of concentration helps us to get stiller and stiller. At some point, this sublime happiness or contentment or warmth falls away or fades away. And then what's left is a very deep state of peace. Tradition often calls a state of equanimity. And because in that state of equanimity, there is no longer any pain. You don't feel anything uncomfortable anymore in this state. So it just feels, you know, no discomfort, no pain. But since this joy and this happiness that was there earlier has also fallen away, there's no pleasure either, or no happiness either in it. And so neither pain nor pleasure, but it's not neutral. It sounds paradoxical, but one of the most pleasant things you can experience, even though there's no pleasure. It's just sublime. It's just so sweet and wonderful, and in this, you know, sense of, you know, profound, spacious, open peacefulness and stillness that's there. And here, especially, it depends on which systems of concentration practice you're doing. There's different systems. Different people teach different ways. But in this deep state of equanimity, there's a feeling of. Sometimes people sense of their breathing stops. It feels like the breathing comes to a full stop. And some people at that point get frightened because you're supposed to breathe to stay alive. And the first time it happened to me, it happened kind of, I didn't notice, you know, it was like, I was hardly thinking, you know, just there and present and just kind of being pulled into this world of being still and quiet. And then suddenly, somehow, I haven't breathed for a while. Took a deep breath, and that pulls you right out of the state. And but in fact, in these deep states of meditation, it's possible to go without seeming to breathe at all, partly because we don't need a lot of oxygen in these states. I don't know what percentage of the energy and the oxygen helps us with the energy and bringing energy to our system. I don't know what percentage is needed for the brain, but a majority of the energy of our system it goes to powering the brain. And so when the brain gets really quiet and still, it doesn't need so much energy anymore. And so without that energy, the breathing can get quieter and quieter. So that's kind of very roughly how these the primary states are. There's four of them, and they go from we kind of fall into them. There's a kind of a shift changed. Often people will feel like a shift comes over them, and that a transition happens, a change of gears happens, and it's not generally something people feel that they can control. They set up the conditions for it, and they're doing their work, and then at some point, lo and behold, there's a something begins to turn over or fall, open up or fall over. I was teaching with Lee Brasington this last week, who teaches this kind of concentration a lot, and he used the expression, you go over the cliff, which is kind of a frightening image. But you kind of go, oh, here we go. Or maybe it's more like you're on the roller coaster and you've kind of gone up and up and up, and ooh, phew, and you go down. You know, maybe, I don't know if that's frightening too, but kind of you feel kind of a shift or a change. So there's four of them, these shifts. So one is to go into what's called the first samadhi, the first jhana, called jhana in Pali. And the first one is characterized by having this joy and happiness, but it has this effort still needed to be present. The second one, the effort to be present is no longer there. We don't have to work at it anymore. And then the rapture, the joy part, stands out in highlight. The third one, the joy falls away and the happiness stands out in highlight. And then when the happiness fades away, then this deep equanimity, deep peace and stillness, it stands out in highlight. So there's these kind of shift changes, and this is the sequence that it takes. So the Buddha gave these analogies for this. It's the analogies sometimes kind of give you maybe more sense of what it is, perhaps, or kind of interesting perspective on understanding these states. So the first state is that of the analogy is that of taking a metal bowl, and this is part of it, you know, the ancient world, they would have, if you go take a bath, in the public baths, I guess, there was a soap attendant who would take the soap powder, I don't know what they used for soap back then, but they had, it was a dry powder, and they still have that in India, dry powdered soap?
You know, I took soap from here.
You took soap from here. Anyway, so dry powder, and they would sprinkle it with water and oil, and then they would knead this flour of powder until it became a ball of soap, and then they would make sure it was saturated all the way through, so that all the moisture was saturated all the way through. It's kind of like making dough for bread, I suppose. You take the dry flour, you put water, and you knead it, and mix it until there's no more dry flour anywhere, and it all holds together well. And you knead it, you work it. And so there is still this working. There's effort being made still in this first state. It doesn't require much effort. The mind's not really, going to go away. Easily, just you're there, but you're kind of still focusing on the breath, for example, or focusing, you kind of stay present, be there, stay there, encouraging yourself to hold it right there. And that's the needing, the being there with the experience. Or the stroking of the cat, you're going to stroke and stay there, kind of make the effort there. What's very nice about this image of kneading the flour until it's all saturated, the instructions that are given here is you take the feeling of well-being and joy that's coming up in that point, and you take your time to you hang out with it and let it spread throughout the body, let it kind of become infused in through all your pores. So sometimes this kind of joy arises, and first it arises some places in the body, in the face or in the hands or some place in the chest. But the idea is to make it all pervasive, so it becomes kind of really established and strong. And then the next image is still with water. It's interesting. The images are water, having to do with water. The next one for the second jhana, second stage, you no longer have to do any work. And so nothing's needed from the outside. So sprinkling from the outside the water, kneading it, it's like there's work from the outside being done. And the image of nothing coming from the outside is that of a lake that has no rivers or streams that come into it. And so it's not being fed by that, and there's no rain happening. Just that, but rather where the water is coming to replenish the lake is there's an underwater spring that's gushing up from the floor of the lake. And this current of water flows up from the spring and fills the lake. So now the movement is internal. It comes inside ourselves, as opposed to inside the system, inside the samadhi, inside the concentration state, as opposed to us still a little bit on the outside working it and doing it. And this feeling of the upwelling spring in the lake is this rapture that arises. It just bubbles up, which sometimes is very strong, kind of gushing through the system, and sometimes it actually feels like a current of energy or current of joy or something that happens. It can be quite intense. So the lake is still, it's not being, and there's nothing coming from the outside. We're not really listening to anything or hearing anything or being input from the outside. There's nothing coming, no input from the outside in terms of the mind making the effort from outside the state. It's there. And then the next image for the third jhana is that of a very still lake, very still, quiet, peaceful lake that has no current inside, no spring inside, just very still. And in this lake, there are lotus flowers floating. And lotus flowers of different colors, so quite beautiful. And apparently some of these lotus plants can flower underwater as well as on top of the water. And so in this simile, a lot of the lotus flowers are, beautiful lotus flowers, are floating just under the surface in the water. So it's very still, cool, very refreshing, nice water, very still and peaceful. Nothing disturbs the water. And these very beautiful things, these lotus flowers that have blossomed, are floating there. And it says, no part of the flower is not touched by the water. And so the water is this peaceful state. And so, the lotus flowers maybe is the feeling of happiness, the sublime feeling of well-being, contentment that's there. Or perhaps it's you. You're the lotus flower. And no part of you is not touched by this peaceful, happy place. It just also suffuses you, kind of fills you. It's everything is there. You're being touched by it. So peaceful, quiet. Then the next image, the lake is no longer there. The water image is no longer being used. But now it's a person who's sitting covered by a white cloth, a completely clean, new white cloth. And and no part of the body is not being touched by this white cloth. So I'm not sure exactly how this image works, but if you ever covered yourself with a white sheet, kind of to hide or something from your parents in bed or something, my son, when he goes to bed, when I'm home, he still likes to hide under the covers so I can come and find him. And, you know, he's been doing it for a long time, and I seem to always find him there, but he loves this game. You make a little kid makes a little house under the table with putting sheets over the sides of the table, and it's cozy in there, and maybe it's a lot of light that day, and so this nice kind of clean white light kind of comes in, still light comes in under the table through the sheets. And you know, you're completely covered also means that you don't see anything. And so it's, all you see in this state, if you see anything, you see light, white. Often there's a feeling of just a golden light or white light that's seen or very still. There's not an input from the outside in the senses and seeing and feeling stuff. Everything gets kind of peaceful and white and clear in a very nice way. Very still. Some people have said that this image of the white cloth is little, kind of the contentment you feel after being completely satisfied in this way. If you're in the desert, thirsty, and you finally see the water, the lake up ahead, then you get really excited, lots of joy and rapture. That's the rapture part of this service. And then you finally get to the water and start drinking, and you take some big gulps, and you're still thirsty, but now you drink in a happy way. You're so happy. You're no longer excited and running to the water because you're so thirsty. Now you're content. You know you're at the water. And so now it's very satisfying. Just drink the water. And then once you've satiated yourself, had enough to drink, then you sit in the shade in the tree in this little oasis and cover yourself with your nice towel. Maybe you've taken a bath too and gotten clean. And then you sit there very content and happy. You've had enough. And you're safe and had enough. And so this way of sitting there with a blanket, sitting there with a towel or the sheet over you is this idea. So there's a lot of variations of how these particular states are experienced. So, the way I described it is kind of just very approximate. I wasn't trying to be very technical, because it's better not to be too technical or exact because of the great variations in which people experience them. Some people will experience each of these states with great intensity. A lot of concentration intensity goes into it. And some people experience them with just very little intensity. And so they're much milder, the states, and closer to ordinary states of consciousness. The intense ones are further away from ordinary states of consciousness. And exactly how some of these things are experienced, the happiness or the joy or the peace, is sometimes idiosyncratic. Different people experience it different ways for who knows what reason. But that's why sometimes the images, those similes of the lake and sometimes speak to a wider range of people, because sometimes similes is easier to find yourself than if you give a technical description of exactly what's going on. The people who have these kinds of states and can experience them find that they're extremely satisfying and sometimes very meaningful to have them, because there's a sense of safety, sense of well-being, sense of joy, sense of that that feels complete or feels very good. It's hard to have that kind of feeling in daily life. Not impossible, but it's hard to have it. So it's very satisfying, very meaningful. It's very, people who are like sensual desire are really happy in these states, because there's a lot of sensuality in these states. And very people who have lived with a lot of conflict in their lives find it very meaningful, because there's no conflicts. Like almost like conflict has been healed in these states, and just states of conflict-free peace, safety, confidence that's there. People who experience a lot of anger and hostility can feel almost as if there's a lot of love coming out of these states. It's very closely akin. In fact, not a few times in the Buddha's teachings, he describes coming into these states with loving kindness as the primary kind of focus of attention for the state. So the loving kindness experience of love or compassion becomes quite intense and beautifully intense in these kinds of way. You know, ordinary love, is a little bit, you can feel love for someone or feel love in a kind of a state that lingers for some while, but it's easily lost touch with, because it's so easy we start thinking about something else, you know, and then, oh yeah, you know, I'm with my lover. You know, we come back and, you know, then we think about something else, and, you know, it kind of comes and goes or something. But with these strong states of concentration, the states of love, you're not going anywhere. That's the idea. That's the focus, and you're there with it. And as this experience of loving kindness is just there, and you go through these four different stages, by the time you get to the fourth one, it's really, you know, just that's basically all there is. You're sort of abiding in a beautiful state of love or compassion. And sometimes these will arise naturally by themselves for people as they're doing this practice. In Buddhism, the point of these states are not the states themselves. And some Buddhist teachers will warn students to avoid them or don't get too caught up in them, because there can be a form of attachment, and because there can be dead ends, because they don't really open up, they're not what liberation is. If you go to a good Zen master, who's a great meditation master perhaps, but and tell them you're having some of these states, if they're polite, they'll just yawn. And if they're more strict or something, they might kick you out of the monastery, or nothing, or say something, or they'll say, look at you and say, you know, come in and you say, these states are great, you know, what do you think of these? And they say, oh, now you're going to suffer a lot. To help you not to get so caught up in them. But they are useful states, and they should be respected and honored, and when they happen, I think, and be supported. And we don't have to be so afraid of them, because as long as we have mindfulness going, they're self-correcting. You don't have to worry about getting caught in them. There are people who get stuck in them for a little while, but that's not a terrible thing. I mean, to be stuck in joy, I mean, you know, I mean, what's wrong with that? And it isn't, you know, it's like pretty good joy. I mean, it's not like you got drunk, or not like cocaine or all these other things, you know. It's not like you went out and, you know, did all kinds of kind of sensual things that people do that they wake up afterwards and, what am I doing? It's clean, good fun. And it's self-correcting over time. Over time, it shifts, so you don't have to worry about it. And the function of this that I talked about already in this series, but one of the primary functions is to really help us to loosen up the grip of our attachments, and loosen up the grip of our fear, loosen up the grip of our hate. This is kind of a very deep tenderizer, like a meat tenderizer, a tenderizer of the heart, tenderizer of the mind. And it's, you know, when we're really stuck and hard in our attachments or fears or desires or angers and all that. And so it's a great help to soften and soften the mind, soften the heart. And because of that, just that is good. Because of that, it helps soften the mind, relax the mind enough that it's more possible for the mind to have deeper insights and to have experiences of liberation, radical experiences of letting go. A mind which is kind of frozen, mind which is hard, mind which is, you know, kind of, you know, it's like, you know, if your hand gets cold in the wintertime, in the icy weather, and it gets all numb, and it might be, you can't uncurl it. You can't use your hand until it thaws. But once it thaws, then you can open your hand. It's kind of like that. Sometimes the mind or the heart it gets so hard, so frozen, that we can't open it, can't free it. So it has to thaw. And so these concentration states is one way in which the mind thaws. And so once it's thawed and soft, then it's easier to let the deepest forms of liberation, of freedom, letting go, to happen. So next week, I'll talk, the last series, I'll talk more about how this concentration stuff works together with insight practice, mindfulness practice, and how the kind of insights that are used with the concentration as a basis can lead to liberation and freedom. So sit, meditate, relax, shift from thinking to sensing, relax into what you're focusing on, and enjoy yourself. But not the kind of joy that's thinking about it. Just enjoy. Thank you.